Hello, everyone, and welcome to Primecast. In this segment, I have a very special guest with me, the one, the only, Doug Hamilton.
Hello, everybody. Happy to be with you, Emmanuel. Always good to talk to you, and I've missed you since getting to spend so much time together last month at Gen Con.
I know it was so awesome to go to Gen Con to get to connect. And so we're going to talk about Gen Con a little bit up front and our experiences and getting to demo Mark IV. And then in the end of the segment, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that Doug has been working on.
Yeah, that sounds great. Let's do it.
So for anybody out there who might not know who you are or might be tuning in for the first time, why don't you tell everybody who you are and what you do, Doug?
Sure. Most people know me at this point, but I know we have a lot of new people that are checking things out. So my name is Doug Hamilton. I am the lead 3D sculptor at Privateer Press. I am coming up on my 10-year anniversary at Privateer Press. That means I have sculpted a lot of models for this company. Yeah, some good and some bad, but that's how it goes.
I like to refer to you as the resident dream crafter. You have literally taken things off the page and sculpted them into life. And so it's been awesome to get to work through that process with you as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a perk of the job, and you and I have been friends for a long time, even before we were coworkers, and being able to actually get together on some of your first projects at Privateer Press and be able to sculpt those models was I thought it was great to be able to collaborate on those.
You've been part of a lot of my first because this past Gen Con was also my first Gen Con.
Yeah, it's Gen Con is something crazy. It was about my 15th Gen Con, so I kind of knew what to
Epic.
expect. But it was great seeing people that had only been there one or two times or hadn't been there at all. So it's always great to see the reaction.
It was really good to get to see everybody and get to meet with everybody. When we opened up the booth, getting to set it up, we put up on Primecast on Plus on the last episode, and it's fun, labor intensive. You get to build a big castle out of Legos, so that was amazing. And then everybody showed up. We got to stand in line and talk to people, and there were so many people I got to take pictures with. I couldn't even list them all because we'd run out of time on this episode.
Yeah, that's really the best part for me is getting to see everybody and getting to see how excited they are. And this year with the Mark IV making a premiere and kind of surprising people, they were super excited and everybody had lots of questions. So it was great.
Now you got to sit at the demo table for Mark IV and demo the game, play it with people. How did that go? What were some of the highlights for you?
Really, for me, it was one of the first times I had sat down with those casters and those jacks. So I was reading through them the night before and figuring out what to do. And man, once I got a couple of games in, a couple rounds in, I was like, these casters are really good and the jacks are good. And I think it's the first time I ever got to use Signar in a game.
Well, that's cool. It's a learning process for sure to pick up any game. And it was really cool to see how many people who had played Mark III sit down and say, I've played this before, and then walk away and say, it's not that different. It feels good. It feels, fun and interesting. There was a lot of buzz around Orgoth, too.
Yeah, definitely. I had a lot of people that had played previously or hadn't played in an edition or so, and they once they knocked the rust off a little bit, they were throwing down. And so although there were a lot of people that would come up, and I would just explain the changes going from Mark III to Mark IV, or in some cases Mark II to Mark IV. And once they understood those changes, all I had to do was sit there and watch them beat up on each other.
That's the best part too, because man, those warcasters can get up in the mix.
They can, especially Horus, the Orgoth caster. I played a game against a buddy of mine last weekend with him, and that guy is so good.
He definitely leans to some of those moments where after you drop the dice and like chop off a warjack arm, you want to run around the table and just shout and ah, like
Oh,
he's so fun.
yeah, literally, and that's what I did with him last week. And my buddy, he's an old Mark One player even. In fact, he did a battle report in like the very first No Quarter magazine or something ridiculous. And
Nice.
yeah, he was like, wow, those guys hit hard. And I'm like, oh yeah.
Orgoth are no joke. And one of the cool features is like arm gets chopped off and you're like, it's magnetized.
What you see?
So it sounds like you had a lot of fun demoing. Were there any other big highlights for Gen Con that you were like, man, just this is a big takeaway for me?
You know, I mean, like I said earlier, I've been to so many Gen Cons now, and part of that reason is because it's close by. But at this point, the biggest thing for me is really getting to see my coworkers because I'm remote. So at Gen Con, you know, I get to see 10 people that I don't normally get to see, or I get to see once or twice a year. And this year it was really great because there was a special camaraderie with our team this year. You know, every night we were all together, and there, whether it was one big group or, you know, two smaller groups, but every night we were all looking, what are you doing tonight? You know, where are we going for dinner? And it was kind of special. It really was.
It's true. That group camaraderie is the best. If you can take a group, you and your friends, and it's like, hey, let's get a room block, let's all get together. It's one of those really just unique and amazing experiences because as soon as the convention is over, every hotel lobby, every hotel restaurant, most of the restaurants with tables are just filled with nerds. It's just we're
Yes,
everywhere. And
everywhere.
it's standing room only in some places, and everywhere you look, people are playing and throwing dice and moving cards, and it was just it's an elative experience for me. I think one of the big takeaways that I felt from this convention specifically was momentum. I felt like, man, we were just coming out with so much steam. Like I met more new Monsterpocalypse players than I could count. Like they were lining up at the table to play demos like it was a sideshow attraction. I was like, well, come one, come all to the Munpock table.
Yeah,
But
definitely. I was at the table next to you, and I saw the action taking place, and I saw you running around celebrating, and so I could tell everybody was having a good time.
I can be a bit of a ham at shows for sure. If you want a religious wild game experience, like come play me at a convention and you will have laughs and we will all have a good time. And I felt the same. Like every time I turned around to the War Machine tables, every time I turned around to the Riot Quest tables, there were players slamming out demos, walking over, buying product and saying, I'm ready to play. This is new. I'm engaged. And so that was really exciting. And then there was just so many returning players that like, hey, I played Monpok in Mark 1, I played War Machine in Mark 2, and I'm so excited for the new changes. I took an edition off, but now's my edition to come back. And people have been just endlessly sending me pictures of them in their game stores or like setting up in their game stores or game stores buying product and putting it on the walls again. Come into this arena, and I can not wait to talk about what you've been working on because that's what's next.
I'm here for it.
So, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've been sculpting?
Well, that's the elephant in the room, isn't it? Everybody is like, what are you working on? But they really kind of know what I'm working on. They just want to see what I'm working on.
Everybody leans into the microphone. Tell us, Doug.
Right. Tell us. Well, it's not a secret I'm working on Dusk, which, for those people that don't know, Dusk is one of the new factions coming out with the Mark IV. I believe it's slated for next April, but it's the evolution of what became of the Retribution of Syra, and things didn't go particularly well for them. That's what happens when you kill your gods. But but they they look pretty good, and there's nothing I can show yet. I know people are dying to, you know, to see what, you know, what Dusk looks like, because they literally don't know. They haven't seen a they haven't even seen a piece of concept art. And I can tell you, as a gamer, having to sit on this information and sit on the models I've been working on for the last few months, that's tough. Because I want to share, because things are looking good.
You showed me some of the proofs at Gen Con and my jaw hit the floor. I know we're being a tease right now because everybody's like, just tell us. But
Right.
like as a longtime War Machine player, I felt like instant buy-in just on aesthetic. Like these look amazing. Of course they've been sculpted by you, but I mean, I'm here for it. Like to steal your words, I'm here for it.
Yeah. And the thing about a faction like Dusk, you know, Dusk is brand new, so even though it has some remnants of Retribution, you can see the Retribution influence. It's new, so working on this faction and trying to figure out how the armor sits and how these hip plates work and how these shoulder pads work. And this is what the concept is, but is that going to translate well to 3D? It's had its own set of challenges because there's nothing to fall back on. There's not 20 years of what does Signar armor look like, or what does Protectorate armor look like, you know, or how thick is Kador armor? Oh, we can just look, and there's nothing like that. So there's been a lot of back and forth on this with myself and Ron Cruzy and with Matt Wilson on trying to get this right, and they're making me work. They're
Good.
they
I
haven't
love Ron Cruzy. He's awesome.
yeah they haven't let me mail anything in yet, so I am finally getting to the point where models are getting approved, and so that's been satisfying. So now it's just a matter of continuing to plug away, because I have so many to work on, but to continue to plug away and eventually get to see some prints of the models and some painted versions of the models. And I'm as excited as anybody for them to be shown.
Well, if that doesn't get your mouth salivating for some dusk, I don't know what does. Well, you've got me all hyped up, and I can't wait. So, are there any other projects that you've been working on, or any other projects that, like, you know, of this past year, as we're coming through the summer now, you know, you've have had a lot of projects hit the shelves that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, well, as you know, I worked on a lot of Mon Pakk this year and towards the end of last year. So I worked on a lot of the ancients, and I know you and I have both been very happy to share those with the community. And once those started releasing over the summer, and also some of the Necroscourge, and I'm trying to think of what else, some of the units for the ancient ones. There's been some things that came out this summer that I forgot that I even worked on. But now I think I'm down to Dusk. I think everything I've worked on earlier this year has been released, and you know, I've been working on Dusk a couple of months now, so I think we're at a point where you're not going to see anything new from me for well, until we actually show some of the Dusk previews.
So you have quite a few trips coming up in the near future where you're going to get out at, with the community and play some games and see things firsthand. What do you have coming up on the horizon?
Yeah, I definitely have a lot of trips coming up. My schedule got very busy at the once we announced Mark IV. So the first thing I have coming up is in a few weeks, I am going to be in New Jersey at Mythicos, and we're doing a War Machine Mark IV event there with battle boxes. And so I'll be hanging out with the community and talking to people, throwing some dice, and just basically doing my thing, you know, playing games.
That's awesome. It's good to hear that you're getting out there, and it sounds like this is going to be basically you know, a big event where everybody gets to come and play some rounds with the battle boxes and learn how they work and the modularity of it all, and they'll get to hang out with you and Matt Wilson.
Yeah, it's an unusual for Matt and I to be attending something together outside of a major con. So I'm pretty excited about it. We don't get to spend a lot of time together, and he and I have a lot of similar artistic influences. You know, we're close to the same age, so we kind of grew up on the same artists and types of art and everything. And so it'll be fun to hang out with him, and it'll be fun to get out and make a splash on the East Coast and get some people hyped up for Mark IV. And if I can pull it off, I'm going to see if maybe I can bring one of these other Orgoth casters to play in some battle box games.
Nice. Speaking of making a splash, you are going overseas to make a splash too.
That's what I heard. So for many years, I have wanted to attend the World Team Championships, which, if you're not familiar with that, that's where nations around the world send five-man teams to play War Machine. And this year it's in Belgium, and Privateer Press is going to be attending for the first time. And I am happy to say that I was one of the people that they asked to attend to represent the company. And so I'm super excited about that. I've been to Europe for War Machine a couple of times. So the only time I get to see some of those friends are at events like this. So to interact with the community on such a large scale is just, and man, it's just going to be humbling. And I'm super excited about it. And I've been dying to tell people that we're going. And yeah, I can't wait.
The WTC, I see it a lot as kind of like War Machine Olympics. There's also Solo Master, so even if you don't have a team but you want to go and attend, like you can still go there in person and play and represent yourself and represent your country if you want. And Solo Masters is also crazy and exciting. And for the most part, you'll have all of the teams over there playing in the team tournaments. So you don't have to worry about them.
Right. And it's going to be great to see. These are the best players in the world, and a
Yes,
lot of them are,
absolutely.
they're, I mean, a lot of these guys, they have huge personalities, and they're just great players. And based on all the people I've met, talked to, and I've talked to so many people just online, BSing about War Machine over the years, that it's just going to be a fantastic experience. I just can't wait for it.
It's a really good community dipstick too, because you get to see what people are playing from all over the world. It's not just what people are playing at your game store or in your backyard or something. We have people, thinking about the game at the highest level and then coming together to sit down and battle it out. And the influences of their regions, of their local players, of their personal preferences, all of that kind of plays through in its own way too. So, like you said, big personalities, there's so many ways that that translates in War Machine on the table. And so I'm always so excited to see what everybody brings, what tricks they pull out, and I know this one's going to be a big one.
Yeah, and these players, they like to bring the surprises. So if you're looking for what the next hot list is going to be, or what the big surprise is, that these are the guys that bring it. They definitely throw some curveballs.
Awesome. Well, I think we also have one more convention coming up that you and I will get to hang out at, and it's in your backyard.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about Warfare Weekend, and that is definitely in my backyard. It's about 15 to 20 minutes from where I live, so I call it my home show. It's usually the last show of the season. It's a super casual show. I mean, there's a lot that goes on, but again, I get to see friends from all over that come in. I get to see friends that I live locally with that I don't ever get to talk to, but they come to that show. So we get to hang out. I know that one of my besties, Aaron from up in Seattle, he's coming down for the show. I didn't realize you were getting to come in, so we'll get to hang out. So it just makes that show that much better. And I'm super excited for that too.
Well, it's right around the corner as well, so there's a lot to look forward to. Still a lot going on in the War Machine and the convention season arena, so lots to come.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy couple of months for me. So and somewhere I have to fit sculpting in, and but I'm plugging away pretty good at it. So Dusk is coming along great. I've got a couple of casters approved. I've got the first unit of infantry looks like it's approved. I've got the jacks almost finished with all their loadouts. And some people have asked, so well, what do the jacks look like? And I'm like, well, they look sleek and evil. And the one or two people that have actually seen them have agreed that that's a perfect description.
Yeah, I would agree. Sleek and evil seems appropriate.
Yep. So I'm excited to share that. And there's just a lot going on. I mean, I literally went from COVID to F1.
Well, do you have any parting shots you want to say before we wrap up here?
I don't. I know that people are itching to see Dusk and what I'm working on, and I know that it's tough to be patient, but as a gamer, I sympathize with you, but just hang in there. I'm going to make sure it's worth the wait. And in the meantime, pick out a different faction to play until Dusk releases.
Awesome. In the next segment, I'm joined by Jason Soles and Eric Ryerson. We do a Q&A and answer some of the community questions and then talk about Cadre and a few other things that were on the devs' mind. So be sure to stay tuned for the next segment. Want to say roll drums?
Roll drums.
Epic.
It's the new theme.
How's it going, everyone? And welcome back. In this segment, I'm joined by two of my favorite people, Jason Soles and Eric Ryerson. How's it going, guys?
It's going great. How's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great, and it's good to have you on. And we've got some exciting topics to talk about today. We're going to dive into some Mark IV questions, answers, and some clarification. And so with that, we're going to dive right in. No reason to really waste a lot of time on anything else. Eric, you had brought some questions to this from the beginning that you had from the community and through talking to some people. Why don't you start us out?
Well, we're trying to illuminate, answer questions, and just sort of give insight on decision-making for a lot of things that have repeatedly come up, whether through our feedback email or simply being posted online. Mm-hmm. Unit movement, probably at the top of that list for things people are interested by and or concerned about. The main thing to take into note is that it is the biggest change from previous mechanics, and it'll be the longest to fully understand for many veteran players. Many decisions we made with how they interact is based upon the fact that they now are a new role in the game that didn't quite previously exist. Things that people have noticed is such as a unit that runs through something like a hazard and then places the rest of the unit on the other side, the rest of the unit is unaffected. That's part of a balancing element with the fact that units are smaller and occupy a different role rather than sabotage the entire unit, or in the past where sometimes you were completely immune to infantry based upon having some sort of defensive measure. Having something set up where it's not as detrimental to a certain unit type, preventing their use entirely. Similarly, with the new replacement of free strikes where you lose your combat action by disengaging, a charging model of a unit will place the other members beyond that, and the rest of the unit doesn't lose their combat action. This feels wrong to a lot of people, but at the same time, it's also sort of as intended. There's still a penalty. You still lose the initial guy. And if that unit has been dwindled down by enemy fire at all, it'll especially be felt. It doesn't sabotage things entirely, though. And if you're having trouble conceptualizing how that interacts in a real life setting applied to the game, you can just imagine the first guy entangled the people while they were trying to address him and the others squoze their way past, or however you can manage it in your mind. A lot of this is an abstraction, of course, but it's all for the goal of having a balanced and fun game that sort of toes that line for simulation as well.
Yeah, the other part of that is that the new movement system's really an extrapolation. We're combining what used to be the geometry of moving 5 models or 10 models into moving, you know, the whole unit simultaneously. So that one path that one model is taking, that's not really one path. That's an extrapolation, which is why if, say, that model clips a hazard, that model is the only one affected by it. We're trying to quickly jump to the point where everybody's positioned, and so you have to move each individual model. But along the way, there's going to be some granularity shifts in how much control you have over everything. And to, you know, make that fair and even, that one model is going to be affected movement modifiers and the terrain that it crosses, et cetera. But once the other models are placed, that'll determine what affects them.
I'm clearly biased. Like, I know that we've talked about movement here on Primecast before, but I like the new system. I think it's fast and efficient. And then conceptually, like Eric was saying, you can imagine it in different ways, but in, you know, real life, troops do slip through enemy lines and find themselves in different positions. And I think that creates a really unique and interesting role within the game, other than just these are crunchy fodder for the grinder, or these are things that go stand in the way. They have purpose. They have, you know, a kind of a deeper meaning to them. And I really like that role. And then even with the like hazard, right? In real life, if you have a unit and like somebody's running and they're like, oh, we've got to cross these coals. Well, the guy who's running in the front's probably going to take some, like, I stepped on some coals, but everybody's going to follow in his path. They're all going to come right behind him, whatever it happens to be. And he's going to find the way for the rest of them. And I think that's kind of cool that the rest of them get there safe, because like Eric pointed out, units are smaller. And so every loss is felt, and that impact reduces their efficiency. And so if suddenly the whole unit gets nuked because they can't move around on the board, and then they get shot to death or whatever, it's not a very effective unit. And so making choices that balance both the concept mechanics versus the actual real world, I think that this movement captures, you know, both in a really elegant way. So I think it just takes some getting used to, because if people aren't used to this play style, aren't used to these concepts yet, you have to relearn. And relearning anything is even tougher than learning it in the first place, because you have a different frame of reference. And so you have to change that frame of reference to what the new game is and play to the new game. Because as we all know, as gamers, it's one thing to play with your models and play to the best of their ability, but it's a whole nother to play the game itself and to understand its fundamentals. And that's what any war gamer really wants to seek, is to understand that game. So I really do appreciate the points that you both pointed out.
Eric also touched on the units having a new role, which is very much true and intentional. Whereas before, they just sort of moved in position like everything else, except for slower, more methodically, and you had to move every model and unit. Now there's a whole lot of tricks open to units that they never previously had. So the new smaller units sort of moved into this role where they can perform tricks of positioning they could never perform before. And I think it's sort of a compensation for their smaller unit sizes, is that they can really tuck in there and get to places that would be impossible for any other model type. So they've sort of really moved into their own in the new game.
Additionally, I'll add, a lot of people have pointed out things that to them initially appear as abusive or crazy overpowered, but these new things that you're able to do with units, all those things are intentional and part of how new units will fare. And a lot of the balance comes from how you construct your army and how you address units going forward. They won't be as insignificant as many times they were in the past. You will have to address them. You will have to diminish them to reduce their threat and capabilities to you. And the ability for them to be more reactive on the board and be a heavy table presence because of it, a lot of that's intentional. And getting used to that will be a major hurdle to understanding how Mark IV will play long-term. But I think once everyone gets familiar with it, it won't seem as crazy.
Absolutely. The more games you play with it, the more it becomes second nature. And then I think in time, people will just be used to it. So there are some other things getting used to as well. I know that you had brought up Jack Marshals. Let's talk Jack Marshals.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of questions on Jack Marshals. And the answer is kind of simple in that they're not fully baked rules yet. The new armies will not be getting Jack Marshals. However, the old models will be getting a much more refined Jack Marshall rule in the future. And since we only have one presence of it so far, I believe, and that model isn't so devoted to that role that it was important at this time, we're sort of making sure we go slow and make it something that'll be satisfying to everyone going forward, and make it something unique and desirable, whereas in the past, it was often an afterthought or not heavily used.
Those models are still very deeply in playtest as well. And there, as you said, the refinement is still coming along. Our goal is to simplify the legacy Jack Marshals tremendously. And whereas there was a lot of rules that they all shared previously, we're going to move those rules individually to the models themselves so that each Jack Marshal feels a little bit different. It has their own set of capabilities, and keep those rules very, very close to the bone.
I think that you bring up a very good point too about, you know, the fact that they weren't getting played and reinventing their playability. And also a good point out that the new armies won't be getting them. So that makes the legacy armies, those prime armies, more interesting and unique to the game.
Yeah, certainly.
So with some of these changes in mind, we also got a lot of questions about cadre. Can we talk about cadre for a minute?
Yeah, certainly. So the cadres for Mark IV are shared models between the prime armies that the legacy factions are being updated to. So they're approximately 5 models per faction that are shared between their 2 prime armies. So one of those slots will always be the Gargantuan or the Colossal. The other one's going to be the Battle Engine. And then usually the other 3 slots are support models that would be ubiquitous for the faction, for the Protectorate, that's going to be the choir, for instance, that will take up one of those slots.
That's a great example. You know, something that needs to be in every army that's obviously useful for all the things. I think that sheds some light on what we're going to see too, right? We can expect Colossals and Battle Engines, and that they will also be shared between armies, so you'll get the max amount out of your investment, because those are big and expensive models.
Precisely. And sorry to surprise everybody with the fact that they've already seen some of their cadre models, but you have.
Great. Awesome. Eric, you had some examples that you also wanted to talk about on some things in playtest.
One of the things we've been hearing about is Trample, and how with its current wording, it's not interacting entirely as intended. We're all very familiar with what Trample's supposed to do from prior editions. However, with the new rules, we didn't quite nail the current edition of wording to achieve that. It's going to be reworked so you will, in fact, be able to get all your attacks as intended, even if the model does not possess the unstoppable rule already. Additionally, currently, Jax have dual attack, which allows you to make ranged attacks after trampling. That will not be the case in the future of Mark IV, so don't anticipate any playtest being able to use it as a significant range extender. We're going to address that with the next iteration of the rules.
I think you bring up a really good point, too, that there's still a lot of rules that are in beta or in playtest and aren't even in beta yet. And so we are giving everybody the opportunity to get their hands on these, take a look at them, give us feedback, check it out. But the refinement is coming, and we have a release date coming up.
Other things we've seen is commentary, a lot of good and useful feedback we've gotten from the community on our feedback email about the Banes and Exemplars and how they're perceived to interact with new armies and each other. And it's a reminder to everyone that they aren't finalized yet. This is a very early edition, and we do intend to have them have strong parity with everything else upon completion and once everything's out. But it was a very good starting point and a good example of how many models you're going to see in a traditional army going forward, a prime army that is, and exactly what level of interactions you'll see and how they'll relatively function within the new rule set. However, that doesn't mean stop sending feedback. We've appreciated all we've gotten, and we've gotten some very thorough and thought out stuff.
So Eric, we have, I think, another question here on the document.
Oh, yeah, we do have one more. Only because we've seen it several times, we thought we might as well address it to clear it up once and for all to prevent speculation on what is the thickness of a line. A line has effectively no thickness. It's a geometric term. Using the edge of an object to achieve a straight line is enough. A laser pointer is good for checking it. However, the thickness of that laser pointer will not add models to the affected one. You know, it has no value for gameplay. All that matters is a single straight point on a plane for measuring from one model to another.
Glad when you clarified, because someone's going to ask. Someone did ask.
Several, actually.
Awesome. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you both on here. I do love talking about Mark IV. I can't wait to see more of it on the table. Is there anything from the new armies as a parting shot that you're just most excited about? Like one model or one interaction that you just love to point players to?
Oh, that thing in Dusk.
Oh, you tease, Jason.
I mean, what I was about to say is no different. I'm really excited for the third Kador caster. I like his theme, and I think people will be excited to see him on the table.
You guys are such trolls. Excellent, though. I'm super excited for those as well. So thank you for bringing it up and ending it on a good laugh.
See you later.
Bye.
How's it going, everybody? And welcome back. In this segment, I am joined by Jeff and Brett. I'm excited to have you both on today. And this was kind of a last minute surprise segment for us. One of our segments got canceled because somebody is at Nova Open this weekend. And so with that, we're going to talk about the recent Monpok releases, and who better than to bring on a couple of the playtesters. How's it going, guys?
Going good. Happy to be here.
I'm here and I'm feeling amazing.
Let's do it.
It's good to have you both on. I know we get to hang out a lot, and it's good to hang out on the mic, get some of those after hours game shop vibes going. So we have a lot of really cool things to talk about. We're going to jump right into. First up, we have Mucustos and Tectamok, who dropped recently. We had the Insider revealing their rules, and so we're going to talk a little bit about those monsters and their units and how it all comes together. And then, if we have time, we're going to talk a little bit about Megaton Mashup 2. We had Megaton Mashup 2 debut at Gen Con, and we sold out of the boxes. And now there's a lot of people that have MagmaCon and Ultra CyberCon in their hands, and so we want to talk a little bit about that and how amazing those monsters are. And with that, both of you really had a great love for these monsters through playtests, that you saw a lot of games, you both championed them very hard. And so I'm excited to have you on to talk about them. Brett, let's start with you and talk about Tectamok.
Sure. Yeah, so Tectamok's a new 11 health protector monster, which is sweet. We haven't seen one of those in a little bit. It's been lots of like 10s and 12s, but going back to some basic 11 health, 6 speed, 8 defense monsters. He's really cool. He's really rules light, which I think is going to make people kind of overlook him a little bit, right? He's only got the 4 on his alpha and picks up, I think, one more in the hyper. But all his rules come together to create like this really efficient kit that I think pairs well with a lot of the more kind of like fast and aggressive monsters that we put out recently.
So let's talk about some of those rules and how they interact. What makes Tectamok, Tectamok?
So the big thing is that Tectamok cares about stomps. He's, I think, the first monster really playing in this space, and I think he does it really well. So he does that in two ways. The first is that his brawl has wrath, which lets him make a stomp, ram, or swat after his after he hits with the brawl, and that feeds into seismic stomp. So he actually gets to punch a thing, stomp, step for free, and then stomp again for free, which is like a really efficient little disruptive package. And then it combos really well with improvised armor, which brings him up to def 9 in alpha, which is great.
Absolutely. I think he's a really interesting monster. And like you pointed out, he pairs great with some of the more recent releases. This being an excellent monster to take a step from the starter box with Hurricaneus in it and take your game to the next level. If you're just starting out, Tectamok makes a great pair there. They can do a lot together. They teach good fundamentals of Munpok. And then on the other side of that, when Tectamok goes hyper, Tectamok is a scary monster to hide from.
Yeah, you basically can't screen from him in hyper. Earthquake, giving him a stomp in addition to anything else he's doing that turn, makes it basically impossible to screen, because he still has seismic step, so he'll stomp, step, stomp again, and there's really no combination of units you can put in front of yourself to keep him from getting to you there. And then he's got collateral damage on power. It allows him to kind of do the Numitor or the Cassandra thing, which is just like, once he hits hyper, he can kind of chain forever. Even if you're only getting, like, say, 1 or 2 power dice per power-up phase, like, because he's got the 6 boost, and he's got these extra ways of generating efficiency, he just kind of, like, Energizer bunnies and keeps going.
Absolutely. He can be really scary in that late game, because there's nowhere to hide, and he's going to get in his power attacks because he's very accurate once he actually gets there. He does what he does very well. And I think he's also really interesting when you combo him with some of the other monsters around that also play in the similar space. We talked about how stomps flip over tiles, and that combo is really great with Incineris, who has Ignite, who can then flip them back over. And you can even create some cool little trap situations where your opponent might have to go in to power attack you, but once they get into position, if they're standing on 2 rubble tiles, well, guess what? You've had the opportunity to turn them on and light them back up. So there's some really interesting play space that this monster opens up with a lot of other monsters, and I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, I'm super hyped to see him get into people's hands. He's a monster I got a lot of love for, and I think he's great.
Let's roll over into Mucustos and talk about the big bug. Jeff, why don't you take it away?
Mucustos is a monster that's really near and dear to my heart. Just as a general overview of what Mucustos is all about, I would describe Mucustos as a toolbox monster. Your kit of abilities really affords Mucustos a lot of options on any given turn, but
you are limited in the number of things that you can do. So it's really a matter of selecting what the optimal choice is on any given turn and executing on that. And that, it, for the most part, comes from Mucustos' infestation rule. This is technically the first time that we've seen infestation on a monster. And what it does is, before you power up, you can take a faction unit, in this case, Savage Swarm, cost one from your reserves, and place it in play adjacent to Mucusto. So what this means is that Savage Swarm has a lot of units that have debuff abilities. So depending on the turn, Mucustos may want to drop a Cliff Hopper and gain the benefit of Sidekick. Or he may want to spawn a Spyfly and make use of his pretty decent gun. He also has the new Vice Pinchers, which have the Barb special rule previously seen on Smatavores. So you can kind of give his power attack siphon that way. So it's really about, like, every turn you're getting one unit, but what unit you want is really dependent on the board state.
Mucustos is a really interesting monster and plays in a space with units that I really like and I think that is really interesting to think about. And here we have Technomach, who's very simple, very streamlined, very rules light. And then we have Mucustos, who is very thought-provoking and very deliberate and very intensive with his strategy. And so they make great foils for each other too, because while Mucustos is out there pumping out units, getting the most out of each exchange and trying to play this shadow game, so to speak, you have Technomach, who's just a freight train barreling down, trying to smash every bug in his path.
Yeah, for sure. They are sort of counters to one another in that regard of like, Technomach is very good at removing units. Mucustos is very good at putting them out. Technomach generates a lot of power. And when Mucustos goes hyper, he picks up a new rule called Parasite, which will drain you of power. And what Parasite does is it's pretty similar to Riled, which is a rule most players should be familiar with. Whenever Mucustos gets hit, you as the Mucustos player gains a power die, and also your opponent loses one. So it's sort of the siphon to Riled's Fury.
It's a interesting dynamic between these two monsters too, because we talked about how good that Technomach is at chaining because of his hyper and his ability to gain a lot of power and be taking the most out of the tempo. And then here we have Mucustos, who can literally just take the wind out of that sail and say, you can chain against me, but it's not going to be as favorable as you think it is.
Yeah, Mucustos makes it very inefficient for most monsters to chain into him, especially once he goes hyper.
And what we mean by chaining, for anybody who's really just getting into Monsterpocalypse, and these are some of the kind of more elaborate concepts and themes within the game, is that there is a certain tempo, kind of like in chess or in other games, where as you play, the more you take monster or unit turns, the more it affects that tempo. And so you do reach a point in the game where you want your monsters to make multiple turns in a row, whether it be to make more the most out of their attacks, or you have a really efficient power base, or you're backed into a corner and now it's time to dig out. We refer to that as chaining, taking their monster to monster turns. Both of these monsters play in that space in different ways and interact with each other in different ways. And speaking of opposing monsters, though, we have a box that just dropped that has two monsters that were both designed to be opposed and voted into this box by the community. Let's talk about Megaton Mashup 2. So with Megaton Mashup 2 dropping, we have Magmacon and Ultra Cybercon in that box. Two new monsters, one for the Pterosaurs and one for the Uber Corp Industries. And both of them play very unique and interesting games and bring things to the table that are different completely from each other and from things in their own factions. So let's talk about those. Brett, why don't you talk about Ultra Cybercon first?
So apparently I'm just standing speed 6, def 8, 11 health monsters tonight. So Ultra Cybercon, he's got Troubleshoot, which is now seen on Defender X and is great there too. He's got Toe, and the big thing is he's got Double Duty, so he can do both of those at once. If I was going to like kind of group him in with his faction, he plays the most like Mecha Maxim, and they actually make a really great pair for exactly that reason. He also has like a really disruptive blast in that he's got a range 4, 4 boost strafe gun, which I believe this is the first strafe gun in Destroyers. So that's super slick. That's kind of it for his alpha. Like, he's kind of doing the toolbox thing we were talking about with Mikustos, right? He's got a lot of options, but for him, it isn't a matter of, like, which option to choose, because he has access to all of them all the time with double duty. He instead has to figure out exactly when he wants to do them, or accept that sometimes they just won't happen at all. Like, you don't need to troubleshoot if you never miss.
One thing I like about Ultra CyberCon is that Ultra CyberCon can play a very aggressive game and a very passive game, with the ability to go up and strafe down buildings and generate power and be disruptive. This monster can be in your face as soon as the word go. But with Toe, you can also play a game where you find a pocket and you move a unit to screen you and make it impossible for another person to align with your monster to do a power attack without additional effort of de-screening tools like another monster or an ability that gives you an extra attack. And because of that, Ultra CyberCon can play to anybody's playstyle. And I think that is a really interesting trait to that monster.
Yeah, I'll agree. And just to, like, give some other cool little Toe tech, once again, back to Maxim, but really any monster that can move a unit, combined with Toe, you can, like, kind of cheat some midfield secures by towing jurors out of your back line early into midfield positions and then moving something else to help secure those buildings. Get you some free reclamation facilities that way.
That's really interesting, too, being able to move something into position a little further upfield so that you can get secures from buildings that aren't in your back line. And this can give you access to other abilities that can give you more tactical options. You mentioned the reclamation facility, and what's neat about that one is that with recycle, it almost has a gun, right? It has the ability to reach out and eat another unit. Well, with the ability to also give you power, and since it can be done on the monster turn, we were just talking about how powerful a tool it is to screen yourself and protect yourself from power attacks. Now, here is an sneaky way that you can set up in the building draft to where you have something that can eat somebody else's unit. And this plays into that chess-like game of thinking ahead on not just where you want to stand, but where you want your opponent to stand too. Let's talk about Ultra CyberCon's Hyper. He goes nuts, and he has some really cool abilities that are unique to him.
He's got Charge Up, which is, like, absolutely 100% unique to him. And Charge Up doesn't actually do anything by itself. You just perform the action and then your next attack is ultra charged. So what it actually does is it powers up the gun and his power attack, gives them both super damage. So that's really sweet. So you can spend a red dice to get super damage on your next attack, which is huge, or on the power attack. But there's a trade-off this time, because he does lose double duty. So instead, he still has troubleshoot, but if you ultra charge, you lose the reroll. So you get a bigger damage swing, but at the cost of safety. But the nice little trade-off is that he has Command Matrix in the Hyper as well. So now all of your stuff has troubleshoot, so it doesn't necessarily have to come off of him.
Best parts of that is giving it to an ally monster, right? So that way, if you set it up to where you know that you're going to need the extra damage and you're giving away the reroll anyways, now the other monster can maybe play a little bit more risky. And one of the things that I always liked about the troubleshoot rule, which we mirrored, like you had mentioned, on Defender X as well, is that it gives you this sense of almost piloting a mech. I love to use the dice calculator for this, because you can punch in something's defense and then how many boost dice and white dice and power dice that you're going to use, and it'll give you the mathematical breakdown of how often you're going to hit that attack. And with that, there is a reroll toggle that you can turn on and off. And so being able to factor in additional risk is what that kind of targeting matrix feel is all about. And so that's where the command matrix comes in. And I think that it's also really great for new players if you're getting into the game, because being able to have rerolls built into your monsters that can be on either monster means that sometimes when you have a game that might be decided by a single roll, you have another shot at it.
I'm just going to highlight what you mentioned there about efficiency, right? Using the reroll to, like, cheat your numbers down is a huge source of advantage that CyberCon delivers with his kit.
Jeff, do you want to tell us a little bit now about MagmaCon? Let's get into the Pterosaur's Walking Volcano.
Yeah, MagmaCon is a really interesting monster. The most obvious thing that players will notice when they pull the card out of the box is that he is, as far as I remember, are the game's first 9 health monster. And that is because he's also the second fireproof monster in Protectors. He is completely immune to hazards, similar to Incinerus. But Magmacon, unlike Incinerus, trades a little bit of mobility for a little bit more bulk. So unlike Incinerus, he is not high mobility, and he doesn't have quite as high of defense, but he does have the +1 health. What Magmacon does bring to the table is some absolutely bonkers, over-the-top, unlike any other monster in the game, power generation. So in Alpha, he's got Onslaught on his Brawl, so he can punch twice, and he also has a new rule called Go for the Throat, which says once per turn, when you hit with the Brawl attack, you can choose to gain power dice equal to the number of super strikes in the attack. So there's a little bit of a push your luck element there of like you roll the first Brawl, you maybe get one super strike and you think I can do better. And then the second attack, you might have an opportunity to get more, or you could get burned and roll 0.
Get burned. I see what you did there.
Yeah, pun definitely intended. He also has Fury on his power attack, which we've seen before on his faction buddy Tyrannix. Basically, whenever he hits with a power attack, he gains an additional red. This is really good for things like chaining, because every throw and every body slam you make, you gain an additional red. He also, if he swats something, he'll gain 2 additional reds, because swats are 2 separate attacks using dice in play. So he can swat one of your opponent's units into another of your opponent's units and get 4 red dice back really simply and easily that way. Or he could, swat a unit into one of your opponent's secured buildings and recoup 5 reds. That is it for the Alpha. Do you want to move over to the Hyper?
That's a spicy meatball. That is all the chunk. And man, he can generate a metric ton of power.
Yeah, if you thought he could generate a lot of power in Alpha, let's talk about the Hyper.
Because, oh my gosh, yeah.
So in Hyper, Magmacon, he keeps Fireproof. He keeps Fury on power, but he also gets his Brawl and his Blast. So all of his attacks are going to generate an extra red for you. And then he has a new rule called Omega Titan. Which says that whenever he hits with an attack or is hit by an attack, he gains a power. And this stacks on top of the Fury that he has on his attack profiles. So every time he hits with an attack, he's going to gain 2 power dice in addition to whatever other power he's getting from destroying models. And whenever he's hit, he's going to gain 1. In addition to that, he is the first monster with a combo strike blast. So what he can do is he'll shoot an enemy unit, he'll get 3 power, and then he can do a power attack that's going to get +3 blues on it because of the combo strike, and that will generate 2 additional power. So it's really easy for Magmacon to just gain 7 power dice a turn just by playing Monpok, which feeds back into some of his other rules, like Pyroclasm, which gives him +1 speed if he's got 10 reds in pool, and +1 defense if he has 5 reds in pool. So if he sits on all those power dice, he can get buffed up a little bit. And he's got an action called Power Blast, which lets him spend power dice to extend the range of his blast attack, as well as the number of blues that blast throws. So you can downgrade the power that you're putting into the attack into boost, essentially, in order to make the gun go a little bit further.
That's a lot of resources. There's a lot that Magmacon brings to the table as a kind of support tank almost. He can take a lot of damage, and then he can dish out a lot of punishment and generate a lot of power. But he can't kind of do all the things, and that's why he needs a good partner.
For sure. He kind of, it's interesting how even though the card is very different on a surface level, The way he feels is kind of a mixture between Armadax and Tyrannix. He plays a lot like his faction mates in that he's very bulky and he's very support oriented, but he can also kind of run away with the game if he's left alone.
So he plays like a pterosaur, this is what you're telling me.
He is a pterosaur through and through.
Excellent. Well, we covered a lot in a short amount of time. Is there anything that either of you would like to say about these monsters in closing here?
It's a great box to split with your friends.
There's some aspects of it we didn't even get a chance to talk about, like the fact that it comes with a whole alternate way to play. So if you like that, you know, one-on-one style that Monpa can bring, this gives a whole new different way to play that. And it is a good adventure for anybody who is getting into Monpa to try out. Additionally, we also have the next Tabletop Simulator tournament coming up that is run through the Monpok Discord. And Brett, you're hosting the next one, am I right?
Yeah. So we're going to be doing the same format as the one we just did. So it's going to be a double elimination bracket. But we also are going to do the other cool thing that happened in the last one, which is we're going to run a non-competitive league at the same time. So you can sign up to either be in the hardcore double elimination bracket, or you can just sign up and give me your name and I'll schedule you a game with someone every week.
Awesome. And I play in the TTS myself, so if you want to hop in and get in a game with me, let's do it. And I know Jeff will be there as well. Jeff, you ready to get some new games in?
Always. I basically live on Discord.
Well, that's all we have for tonight. Thanks for listening, everybody. Don't forget to tune into Primecast Plus coming up later on this month. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and still provide that feedback for Mark IV. You guys want to say roll drums?
Roll drums.
Nailed it. Epic.
It's the new theme.